Yeah, the ninth chapter, chapter of wisdom. As you might have heard, among the practices related to the Buddhasadhu's way of living, the practice of perfection of wisdom is regarded the most profound practice, and also profound in terms of practice itself, profound in terms of discourses or explanation related to this practice. Have you brought this version? You haven't. This one is mixed with the commentaries, so it's a little bit. Otherwise, I can go through the commentaries together, and then make some clarification. That would be easier for me. And for you as well, what should I do? Should I go through this version, or I leave to the students? This one. This one.
Like you say, it's easy.
Pardon?
Like you say, it might be easier to understand.
Yeah, it might be easier to understand if I give some clarification. Also the commentaries. Huh? Okay. From the very first verse of the ninth chapter, we may think that there's no other way. There's no way. No sort of alternative way other than to no alternative sort of way in order to instill the simulated perfection of wisdom while we are as a ordinary practitioners. Apart from undertaking the first five practices before you undertake the sixth one. Comparing the different Madhyamika texts in order to build up our proper understanding, which should be the main sort of tool to which must be the main tool for the practitioners to undertake the practices, starting from practice of perfection of generosity. Now, first I should give some relationship between the 9th chapter and the 8th chapter. As you may be aware, there are three sections in the 8th chapter. First is connecting the 8th chapter with the 7th and instructing the followers to put effort in instilling or producing the samadhi within one's mental stream. Second one is the presentation on the opposing factors of the samadhi. And third one is presentation on the manner of familiarizing or habituating ourselves in the antidote of the opposing factors of the samadhi. So when the author was giving the presentation on the third section, he said that the practitioners, Mahayana followers, the Mahayana practitioners should practice or should familiarize, should habituate ourselves in two kinds of enlightenment thoughts, relative enlightenment thoughts and the ultimate enlightenment thoughts. And then the latter presentation or the latter parts of the 8th chapter dealt until the end of the chapter with the practices, two practices, equalizing oneself with other, and exchanging between others, between other and exchanging other and self. And in the commentary, it is not very clear. That's why I've taken this time to make clarification. Now the second manner of habituating, presentation on the manner of habituating or familiarizing ourselves in the practice of ultimate enlightenment thought. Ultimate enlightenment thought is referred to the actual ultimate enlightenment thought is referred to the exalted transcendental wisdom. In another word, the direct realizations of the Bodhisattvas and Buddha, not the direct realization of Sharvaka Arhat and the Pratyeka Buddha Arhats. Proceeding to as a preliminary practice to that actual practice of actual enlightenment, actual ultimate enlightenment thought, we as ordinary beings have the option to train ourselves in the simulated jesutimba, concordant, or simulated is better, not the actual ultimate enlightenment thought, but the simulated, that is the right person, simulated ultimate enlightenment thought. However, in order to do that, we need the proper and the correct understanding of the emptiness, selflessness, correct understanding of the two truths, I should say. Correct understanding of the true truths. Among the true truths, the ultimate truth is referred to be the object, is referred to be the object of any practice of perfection of wisdom. So in this chapter, First the author has given the instruction to us through connecting this chapter with the preceding chapters. He instructs us to give effort in instilling or producing the wisdom, which is the main tool to overcome the afflictions as well as the karmas, which are the two main resources of all kinds of sufferings. So since we have entered into the path, entered into the spirituality, out of the intention, out of the motivation to fulfill or to accomplish our two natural wishes, wishes to get rid of the sufferings, wishes to have or face the happinesses. There are no, any sort of powerful method or tool or method to accomplish these two. The wisdom is the understanding of the true truths, especially the understanding of the ultimate truth, the ultimate reality of ourself, ultimate reality of the phenomena surrounding us. Ultimate, not only the base phenomena, all kinds of phenomena, whether it's compounded or uncompounded, whether it's entity or non-entity, whether it is classified, the phenomena, there are many classifications, many ways of classifying all phenomena into a different sort of category, different categories. This is explained in the Abhidharma, two Abhidharmas, philosophical texts. So, undertake the practice of wisdom, as at this stage undertake the simulated practice of perfection of wisdom. It is understandable from that we need some level of understanding of the true truth, some level of understanding of the wisdom as presented in the Mahayana text, especially the 9th chapter or the 6th chapter of Madhyamika Avatara. So that was So there is, from that we can see the connection between the preceding chapters and the 9th chapter. Not only from that, but also from the very first verse, as it says, all of these practices were taught by the Mighty One for the sake of all of the above mentioned practices, starting from practice of generosity up to the practice of samadhi. These were taught. The presentation on these practices were given by the Mighty One to the Mahayana followers with the Mahayana, awakened races, for the sake of wisdom, in order to instill the wisdom, So from this we can see, without the basis of the preceding practices, there is no anikasura. There is no way to instill. There is no way to sort of instill the proper wisdom, wisdom knowing the ultimate reality. There's no possibility. There's no possibility to. But in the Madhyamika Avatara, after the supplication, I think this third verse, I don't think it's third one. I think it's fifth or sixth. I'm not very sure. There it says that the compassionate state of mind, non-dual wisdom, compassionate mind, non-dual wisdom, and the enlightenment thought are the three sort of main causes for the ordinary Buddhisattvas in the path of accumulation and Buddhisattvas in the path of joining. These three positive mental states of the ordinary Buddhisattvas are the causes to attain the exalted Buddhisattva stage. When giving the explanation on that in the commentary, referring to one of the Ratnamala verse, there can be two ways of instilling the non-dual wisdom as a ordinary sentient beings. There can be two ways. Here, for the sake of wisdom, when the Arya Shantideva says all the preceding five practices are being sort of presented, are being sort of explained by the Mighty One or the Buddha in order to enhance or develop the wisdom, he's referring to the actual exalted enlightenment thought, not the simulated any wisdom. Because in Ratnamala, it says that the very beginners, the starters of the Mahayana path, there can be two kinds of practitioners. One with the sharper intellectual faculty, one with the dull intellectual faculty. For the practitioners with sharper intellectual faculty, they can study, put exert first in sort of studying the Mahayana texts, and then contemplate, and then instill the theoretical understanding of the truths, ultimate reality. And then out of that theoretical understanding of the true reality of the all phenomena, out of that genuine understanding of the true reality, then he sort of generates, by the force of that understanding and knowing the true reality of the phenomena, and then seeing the conditions, the pure, poor sort of states of the all other mother-like sentient beings who are in the grape in the grip of strong ignorance, he then can be able to generate a genuine compassion towards the mother-like sentient beings. And then familiarizing, undertaking the practice of the compassion, and familiarizing in that, or stabilizing or cementing the great compassion towards the mother sentient beings, he then take the vow. And then he takes the Bodhisattva vow and employ himself in the Bodhisattva practices. Through that way, there's one way for the practitioners with the sharper intellectual faculty. And as in the major, what say, pit instructions of the Mahayana practices, for example, the triple perception. In the triple perception, while presenting the pit instructions of the practice of experiential perception, it starts from the compassion, loving kindness. It starts from the loving kindness, compassion, and then the relative enlightenment thought and the ultimate enlightenment thought. It starts to sort of lead the followers in that manner, in that procedure. That is suitable for the practitioners with the lower, with the dull intellectuals. So we should know that the individual should identify oneself in which categories one falls, and then in accordance with one's disposition, I think, yeah, in accordance with one's disposition, then one should employ oneself in that manner, in that right manner, which is more suitable, more effective, which can be more sort of any beneficial, which will bring which will bring the result or the improvement more quicker in oneself. Therefore, yeah, so there are two manners of undertaking the Bodhisattva practices, as explained in the authentic or reliable Mahayana texts. Therefore, those who wish to pacify suffering should generate this wisdom. So he says, those who wish, we all wish actually, it's our natural, we all wish to pacify or overcome our suffering. Especially the suffering, not only the present life suffering, but also the future, but also the... So I should point here that the difference between the Mahayana paths and Mahayana path, the superior path, which is regarded as the superior path, and the Hinayana paths, which is regarded as the inferior path. There are many sort of seven sort of kinds of aspects given in the Sutra Alamkara, from which we can regard the practice of Bodhisattva as the Mahayana or the great vehicle, and the practice of the commitments or the practice of the Sharvaka followers or the Patiyaka Buddha followers as a Hinayana, the lesser vehicle, because of the seven aspects, I think I gave briefly these seven or five, I think, seven aspects earlier. So, one, the first aspect is the focus or the objects of the practice. That makes the difference, I think, here. Practices are almost same. The Shavaka followers also perform the generosity. They also undertake the morality. They also keep their morality. They also be in a patience. They also sort of and they take enthusiastic joy in their practices. They also undertake in the samadhi, practice of samadhi. They also sort of habituate themselves in the wisdom of selflessness, wisdom which realizes selflessness. So, but from which point, if asked, from which point should we sort of differentiate our practice? From which point should we be able to identify our practice as a Mahayana practice, our practice as not a Hinayana practice? That is the important. That is the important. Otherwise, they may be a danger of falling our practice into the Sharvaka practices, lesser vehicle. Because of not identifying within ourselves the different intention or the different motivation, in another word, the enlightenment thought, renunciation or the enlightenment thought. Without sort of being successful in identifying properly our motivation, our intention, there may be a danger of falling all our practices into a Hinayana path which leads to the self-liberation. There is danger. So from the motivation, as many teachers sort of emphasizes, motivation in accordance with the higher philosophical schools, like Madhyamika school and Chittamatran, as well as the third one, Swatantrika school, except the Vyabhashika. Vyabhashika, they posit wholesome and unwholesome in terms of the physical action, in terms of physical action, in terms of verbal sort of action. Whereas in the higher approaches, the higher schools, where in accordance with the higher schools, the actions, when they differentiate between the wholesome and unwholesome. Within the wholesome, whether that wholesome is a liberating path, whether that wholesome action is liberating path or mere sort of wholesome that ripens their results in the worldly existences. They differentiate these from the motivation of the agents, motivations or the intentions of the agents. So in simplified words, to differentiate the difference between the Mahayana and Hinayana path, I think it is the motivation. So whatever practice is done out of the intention to liberate oneself from, overcome one's own suffering, intention to accomplish one's own happiness, then all practices becomes the Hinayana paths, lesser vehicles. If one perform the practice of action of generosity, action of morality, or the practice of morality, and so on, up to the any practice of meditation on emptiness, habituating in the wisdom, the realization, habituating in the wisdom knowing the ultimate reality, out of an intention to gain the complete Buddhahood for the sake of other sentient beings, for the sake of freeing mother-like sentient beings from the suffering nature of the cyclic existence. That is the point. So the point comes from here. The major points comes from the individual intention. So we need to identify these. So Therefore, those who wish to pacify suffering, who wish to pacify suffering of all other mother-like sentient beings, oneself or who wish to pacify even the Sharvaka paths in order to sort of fulfill their wishes to overcome their suffering, they also need to instill first the simulated understanding of the selflessness, and then they need to sort of habituate themselves in that understanding through the meditation, through the sitting meditation, or through the then the obsession sort of obsession meditations also, I think so. Reason behind this is that all our sufferings comes from the karma and the defilement. Karma means the actions. Defilements, of course, related with our mind, the negative emotions. Defilement means all our negative emotions rooted in the concept of I and mine, rooted in the ignorant concept of I and mine, not the artificial concept of I and mine. Like when the text recommends us to and he conceived the others as I. We do have the concept of I. So that concept of I is artificial concept of I, not an ignorant concept of I. I would say the ignorant concept of I. This ignorant concept of I and ignorant concept of mine are the very roots of all our afflictions, all our irritating emotions. And out of these, then our actions come. Physical actions, verbal actions, also the speculation of something. Wrong speculation, bad speculation. This is a mental action. That wrong or bad or negative speculation of the mind also are sort of caused or invoked by the afflictions, our negative emotions. So from these two, the karmas and the afflictions, these two are the very causes of all our suffering. And then these two, now we need to identify within ourselves. Compassionately, the scholars, the exalted, especially the exalted Buddhasattvas and the Buddhas, they compassionately and he pointed out all these to us in order to save us from the everlasting sufferings. So now it's our responsibility to look inside and identify these as presented, as explained, as pointed by the teacher. That is important. So they say that all sufferings, miseries come from our karmas and affliction. Karma and afflictions comes from the grasping of something as inherently existent, conceiving or clinging or craving the appearance when we see a beautiful form, attractive form, when we hear attractive sort of melodious sound, when we smell some kind of attractive fragrant, then because of that appearance doesn't actually, that we have to understand, these appearance, dual appearance, do not bind us in the suffering actually. Our concept, the most mistake, or the is done by our mind, not by the appearances. Appearances are innocent. They appear out of our karmas and our come out of. We have the appearances, we have these different perceptions out of the force of our, what say, propensities, our propensities of them within our mental stream. They become just there's a condition of object or just a condition of focusing. They are just a condition of focusing. But they do not have intention to invoke our what say generate our any negative emotions. Our wrong concept, craving the appearances as inherently existent, truly existing, attractive form, conceiving or clinging that appearances as a truly or inherently existent beauty. Then, because of that concept, because of that misconception, misapprehension, and then the desirous attachment towards that arise. Out of that, and then out of the desirous attachment, then some kind of action, some kind of, what say, unwholesome actions arises. So he says that he, based on the Buddhist sutra, based on the Buddhist direct teaching sutra, he said that we need to, in order to pacify ourselves, we need to, wage sort of battle. We need to wage battle inwardly with our against the very roots of the suffering. Whereas ordinary beings, they struggle to wage with the secondary conditions, not knowing the very root of the suffering within oneself. So here he says the sufferings of the cyclic existence, all these and the sufferings of the cyclic existence are rooted in the karma and the residues or the seeds of the karma within our mind and the emotions, negative emotions, and that these two concept of misapprehension, the concept of true grasping is the established English term, true grasping of what appears to our perceptions, what appears to our mind. We grasp or we cling or we crave them as a inherently existent or truly existent. So that is the very root. That is known as the one kind of ignorant. Ignorant has two. Ignorant of karma and result, that comes into the class of obscuration of defilement. And this, the grasping, the appearances as truly existent, inherently existent, that concept or the mind, that thought comes into the obscuration of phenomena. In accordance with Karamba, not in accordance with Tsongkhapa. In accordance with Tsongkhapa, Gelugpa, the second one comes also in the category of the obscuration of defilement. So unless we wage war with that very root, we cannot be successful in overcoming the sufferings forever. We can be successful in sort of dispelling or overcoming the sufferings for a short time. In order to overcome the suffering forever, we need to wage war with that very root, with the with the wisdom realizing the real, true reality of the appearances, true reality of our perceptions. So that is why, therefore, those who wish to pacify suffering should generate this wisdom. So generating this wisdom or instilling this wisdom, there's a manual. First to study, then to contemplate. Study means listening the presentation on the wisdom chapter or presentation on the true truths. First we need to listen from the reliable, from the teacher who has the qualifications, The Mahayana teacher must have at least three qualifications: good morality, pure morality, and then genuine compassion, compassion towards the students, and the wisdom knowing the Mahayana texts. These are the three sort of qualities, least qualities should Mahayana teachers possess in order to be a teacher, in order to lead other beings into a Mahayana path. At least these three qualities. That is why in Ratnamala, I am very sure that it said that it's very clearly stated in that Ratnamala, I think so, one of the Nagarjuna's texts. Chöse means one who knows the phenomena, means one who have a good sort of an understanding of the true truths, who have studied well, who have good knowledge of the true truths, chöse, ningji, and then one who possesses genuine compassion, and then one who is with the who possesses the genuine or pure morality, chöse, ningji, chudumde, nyumong seve sharapje, also who is capable of, who has the wisdom, who has the understanding to overcome or to dispel his or others, the disturbing emotions. If you rely on such teachers, then you will definitely understand the teachings. Otherwise, if the teacher is lack of these qualities, even he is so skillful in giving teachings, there will be no benefit for the students. That is the Nagarjuna, he states that like that. So the wisdom is for one's individual practice, or in order to lead other into the right path, or in order to help other beings to overcome the sufferings as well as the irritating emotions. One needs that spiritual friend must have this understanding. So these are the immediate sort of benefits of possessing this kind of wisdom. Now the two truths, deceptive truths, so-called, because they are truths established from the viewpoint of deceived minds. There are different interpretations among the schools. Here the interpretation or the explanation given here is in accordance with the highest interpretations of the Prasangika Madhyamika school. If someone is really sharp, if someone is really intelligent, Normally, our teachers, especially Khenpo Rinpoche, also in the many sort of biographies of the self biography, the autobiography of many sort of renowned scholars from different sort of Tibetan schools, they also recommend the followers with the sharp faculty to study all different kinds of interpretations, to put effort in the comparative interpretations through which one can build up the very right or genuine sort of wisdom or genuine knowledge through which, whereas for the lesser, I think for the followers with the lesser faculty, even within the Mahayana, they should give more sort of emphasis in the interpretation or in the presentation, in the presentation of the Madhyamika score. And then out of sort of believing faith in the author, believing faith in the sort of text, believing faith in the sort of Buddha, with the base of that sort of inspiring faith, then one can build up the believing faith in that this kind of presentation or this kind of interpretation as well. So although there are different interpretations among the four Indian schools with regard to the true truths, in accordance with the Madhyamika school, deceptive truths, relative truth or conventional truth sometimes, deceptive truth, so-called, all our ordinary minds and the perception of our ordinary minds, it's quite easy. Not only our, but also the mind of the Aryas, the exalted beings, the mind of the exalted beings during their off session. These come in the deceptive truth. They are called deceptive truth because they are truth established from the viewpoint of deceived mind, viewpoint of deluded mind, from the viewpoint of deluded mind that obscure the real meaning or the ultimate truth. So our deluded mind is known as the deceptive mental state, because this deluded mind, or the mind which has the dual appearances, dual perception. Our mind, whether it's eye perception, ear, nose, tongue, or body, or our mind, these all are known as deluded mind or deceptive mental state, because they obscure us from seeing our true nature. They obscure us from seeing the true nature of the appearances. Dual appearances, or the true nature of the dual appearances, true nature of ourself, and there are so many ways of expressing that obscure the real meaning and ultimate truth. So that because they are truths comprehended by the superior wisdom, so-called means the ultimate truth, the true nature, the true reality of all the phenomena. It's better, it's easier. All the phenomena, including our five aggregates, The ultimate reality, the true reality, infallible reality, we would say, sometimes it's written in the Tibetan, infallible reality. or the infallible state.
Oh.
Mm. They are known as the true, it is known as the true reality or infallible reality is known as or is posited as ultimate truth, because they are truths comprehended by a superior, realized by, I don't know whether it's comprehend is right word or not. Comprehend is right word. It's same as realize.
More conceptual.
So then this word should be changed. Huh? They are truth realized by superior wisdom to which no deceptive truth appear. That refers to the meditative state. In the meditative state, when the exalted being rests his mind in the true reality of the mind, that very moment, whether they abide in that state for 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15 minutes or 15 minutes or half an hour or 1 hour or during that moment. From the viewpoint of that realization, there's no any sort of dualistic appearances. There's no any dual appearances from the viewpoint of that mind. Like when we think of emptiness, when we meditate on emptiness, when we meditate on the habituate on the emptiness, at that time there's a abstract sort of, some kind of abstract meaning of emptiness on which we placed our mind. That is the object, objective aspect. And the mind which knows theoretically some sort of definition of the emptiness out of some kind of ultimate reasoning. That is the subjective aspect. And then our mind has some kind of action in it while sort of meditating on that. So to that meditating mind of the ordinary sentient beings, there is dual appearances. From the viewpoint of that meditating mind, there are the dual appearances or the aspects of three factors. You call the wholesome aspects of the appearances of the aspect of three factors. So that is why our meditating mind, meditating on the emptiness, is not the actual realization on which we meditated. The emptiness on which we sort of abide in is not the real emptiness. It is the abstract meaning of the abstract meaning. Our direct object of that meditating mind, our meditating mind, is the abstract meaning of the emptiness. It's not the real emptiness. So from that also we can see that our meditating mind is not the direct realization. It's not the non-deceptive or non-deluded mental state. It is still a diluted mental state, whereas the direct realization is the non-diluted state because of not having the dual appearances from that point of view, to which no deceptive truth appears, are accepted as the true truths. So there are true truths. So true truths are in the general meaning, Karamba, I think, many of you may be studying the true truth from the next month. Karamba has given extensive presentation on the true truths. Many presentations, many pages. It's not easy one. Very, 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 very interesting. Because the true truths are the topic, the two major topics of the Buddha teaching. And true truths are the true sort of two natures of the phenomena, relative nature. The relative truth or the deceptive truth is relative nature of the phenomena. And the ultimate truth is the ultimate sort of nature, ultimate reality. Relative reality ultimate reality, relative nature of the ultimate nature, any sort of word. So these are the true truths, are the natures of the all phenomena. And when someone has a good understanding of the true truths, that understanding or the wisdom becomes the very source of immediate happiness as well as the future happiness. Okay, I think it's gone in the earlier chapter, Digpa Pangchari, Tungame, Kevichana, Migame. He says, the Bodhisattva, Shanti Deva, author once said in the earlier chapter, I don't remember which section, he says, since the exalted Bodhisattvas have already overcome the sinful, unwholesomeness, they do not possess suffering. Since they are wise in all kinds of phenomena, wise in abstaining from, wise in adopting, wise in helping, wise in knowing the different states of others, because of being wise towards the phenomena, and then he all as a source of happiness. We can see that also the sufferings comes from the ignorant. All sufferings comes from the ignorant. Ignorant of others, ignorant of others' action, ignorant of the others' intention, ignorant of many things, ignorant of one's own state, ignorant of many, I think, when someone reacts, when we counteract with the many people while alive, while doing something, out of ignorance, out of not knowing the real intention of other person, the real sort of way of one khalsure counteracting, real way of counteracting the true sort of the relative true sort of true infallible way manner of counteracting his counteraction with oneself, and not also knowing one's own sort of state, and not also knowing the one's one, not also being unwise in one's state, unwise in sort of the manner of counteracting against the others, unwise in, because of ignorance, all problems, all sufferings comes out of that. So when someone is very wise in true truths, then that kind of wise practitioner, just do not have any kind of depression, any kind of frustration, any kind of hypertension, tension, hypertension. So seeing the benefit of possessing the wisdom, not seeing the fault of not possessing the wisdom, intellect of the true truths. So we should also, that will also sort of motivate us to sort of first study, then contemplate, then habituate our in self that in that convinced understanding. So true truths, seeing that true truths are the gateway of entering into the practices. Understanding of the true truth are the gateway of entering into the practice. They are also the gateway of studying the different texts, different definitive teaching or interpretative teaching or Mahayana teaching or Hinayana teaching or Tantric teaching or whatever. True truths are the gateway of entering into the texts, entering into one's practices. So true truths are very important. Accessed are true truths. Ultimate truths are no object experienced by the mind. In Tibetan it says ultimate truth is not the object of mind. It's an object of mind. Here the author refers mind to, there are several interpretations actually. But in this Thomas Ambo says that this mind, The mind in this line must be referred to the yang tapa mai berkuntuk. Very difficult to say English because Tibetan sometimes these perceptions, sense perceptions, are known as non-conceptual state, non-conceptual are normally, mostly, they are known as non-conceptual. Now here it says yang tapa mai berkuntuk. In a God, in sort of, in comparing with the comparing with the one sort of line, two lines of the Madhyanta Vibhanga by the Maitreya Nath, is the same that same jung comes from ba. Yang da ma yin kun do ni same that same jung comes from ba. Says the impure, and mind is better there. Impure mind refers to the minds, this mind and with principal minds and sub-minds of all three realms. All three realms, desire realms, form realms, and formless realms. Any kind of mind connected with these three realms is referred as the mind here. So that means the mind with, in another word, mind with dualistic appearances. That is important. Mind with dualistic appearances. So ultimate truth is not the object of the mind with dualistic appearances. So our eye cannot perceive the ultimate reality of the form. Never. Our eye perception never can perceive the ultimate reality of the form. Our ear perception can never any realize or can never sort of perceive the ultimate reality of the different sounds. It can only perceive the relative nature of the sound. Eye perception can only sort of see the relative any nature of the relative reality of the form. So on. And then our mind, as I stated earlier, that is important. When someone do the meditation on emptiness, unless you have that sort of kind of that wisdom, that kind of intellect, differentiating the actual emptiness from the abstract meaning of emptiness, differentiating the actual realization and the simulated realization, or the conceptual state of realization, unless you have the ability to differentiate that, one cannot do the meditation on emptiness properly. So he says the mind here is quite clear now, huh? Doesn't refer to any kind of mind. It's referred to the mind with dualistic appearances. Dual perception is right. Mind with dual perception. Any kind of mind with dual perception cannot see or cannot realize the ultimate truth that we have to keep in our mind. And recall that understanding when we do the meditation on emptiness. Have to be mindful of that aspect. But here the mind is to be understood as a deceptive mind, that obscures one from seeing ultimate truth. Two types of person are seen to experience these two truths: yogis endowed with the concentration of superior insight and calm abiding, and common people who are not so endowed with these two higher mental states. Like the ordinary farmer in the farm, and one of our students at the IBA, comparing to these two, there are big difference. There may be big difference. If not now, in near future, there will be a big difference. Common people consider the body to be unit. Common people. Since the way of seeing the body is changed. For example, my way of seeing the body, my body and others' body, or the form of this house is fabricated. Is fabricated by the influence of having entered into the Mahayana school, entered into the Buddhism. So my way of seeing is already fabricated, already mended. The ordinary being who haven't, ordinary human, like a very ordinary Nepalese farmer down there, who haven't studied any kind of philosophy of any sort of schools, his natural way of conceiving his body and others' body. So common people consider the body to be unit. Body to be unit or body to be as one. The mind to be permanent. His mind he conceived. He has the same mind from the beginning on. Same mind as the mind he had during the childhood. During the younger time, the old man, whose mind is not fabricated by the school, whose way of looking is not fabricated by the school, any of the school, he naturally see his mind as permanent, same as the earlier stage. So that is permanent, seeing the present mind as the same as the. As the same mind of the young age, as the same mind of the childhood. So that seeing that way is seeing mind to be permanent, and so forth. And seeing the body to be cleanliness, whereas the relative nature of the body is kasura, polluted substance. And we naturally see the body as a clean, especially after taking birth, taking sort of bath. We have that concept, seeing them. The body is not unit because it has many parts. However, so forth. Yogis, however, contradict these views with reasoning such as body is not a unit because it has many parts. Because of the many parts of the body, because of the knowing of the many parts of the body, then a yogi or the person who have entered into the school, especially the Buddhist schools, I think, especially the Buddhist schools, they it has changed the way of conceiving, way of seeing the body is changed. Change already, and they see body as with many parts, not as one body. Because it is, and the mind is not permanent because it changes into something else. Unlike the ordinary being, the yogis conceive the mind as impermanent, because of knowing the changing. Or changes of the mental state, or because of knowing the shortest moment, because of knowing the mind as momentary as its relative reality. Because of that, the yogis or the scholars or the wise people who have studied the philosophy, especially the philosophy of these, the Buddhism, they see in that way. Furthermore, among the yogis, the proponents of external existence, refer to the Vaibhashika and the Sautantika. These two schools, out of their intellectual sort of power. Out of their intellectual power, the ultimate intellectual power, they discovered the gross forms, like the tangible form, and the continuum of the sound, and the smell, and all things, all these outer sort of objects, all these outer inanimate objects, the gross of all these outer inanimate objects as a non-true, whereas they have discovered the what's it, the atoms, indivisible atoms, which are indivisible atoms, which are the indivisible atoms, which are the raw materials, which are the raw materials to produce, or to bring all these into existence, into sort of apparent sort of existence, into apparent existence. So those indivisible atoms, they have discovered as a truly existent, because they cannot, because of their lesser level of intellect, they cannot sort of out of their lesser level of intellect, they cannot sort of prove, they cannot sort of find the reasonings within themselves to disprove the indivisible atoms as a truly existent. So they are known as proponents of external existence because of that reason. These two schools are known as. The Chittamatran, the second highest school, the Buddhist schools, Chittamatran and the Madhyamika, there are differences in their understanding of the nature of knowable entities. It is like, I think, four people with the different levels of intellect and then seeing one thing. For instance, when we gather for the meeting, when the staffs gather for the meeting, and then different levels of understanding of specific matter, someone brings up more inspiring sort of, suggestion. Someone's suggestion is not that much because of not having that much, that much level of understanding towards that matter. And then we have a different sort of, different interpretation, different approaches, and different sort of conclusions when we discuss or when we think of any kinds of matter we have. We differ in our, here, and then differ in and doing also because of the here, and then differ in doing something. So similarly, it's similar with the schools. The schools, they have different level of knowledge, different level of understanding, and then they make up of different schools. Someone who has the same sort of level of understanding, they stick together, and then found a school. It is like that. Thereby, those who with the higher views or higher intellectual, higher view in terms of higher sort of intellectual, through which one can see the reality better than the other one, to prove with reasoning, better reasoning, the reality from the other one. So those with higher views progressively contradict those with lower views. So among the four schools of Buddhism, the Vaibhashika approaches is disapproved. Vaibhashika approaches or the interpretations are disapproved. Not all. There are similarity also between these two. There are similarity between these two. There are similarity between all these also. There are. But there are many interpretations or many approaches which contradicts among the four levels of school. With examples such as the magician's illusion, which are accepted as unreal by both yogis and common people, it is proven to be proponents of external existence that although something may appear to their minds, something may appear truly existent to their mind, it does not have to be real. Although they conceive that object as truly existent in order to disprove their, what's a way of viewing, their way of viewing, the illusion is taken as an example. Illusion can be taken as example on which both the proponents and the opponents agree to be non-true. So from that example, the opponent can sort of disprove the opponent, disprove the opponent's theory that the indivisible object or outer object are truly existent. Get it? Thus, if the minds of these yogis can be established as deceptive, so yogis here refer to the scholars, I think scholar is fine. Yogi is actually not here. That's why Thomas Ambo says, even though most of the commentaries refer to this Nanjur in the Tibetan, Nanjurpa Thang Palpa Tzu, Nanjurpa Yang Lokhe, Nanjurpa, it is the term Nanjurpa is being pointed to towards the yogis by many commentaries. He recommends in his commentary to refer the Nanjurpa to the followers who have the wisdom of studying, who have the wisdom of contemplation, who have the followers who have any of the three sort of wisdoms with regard to the selflessness. Any of the practitioners or followers of the school, Vaibhashika school or Svatantrika school, Chittamatana, Madhyamika, followers of any of the schools or followers of Buddhism who have any of the three wisdoms with regard to the selflessness, that should be referred as the Nanjurpa, not the actual yogi who practice or who meditate on that. Thus, if the minds of these yogi can be established, so means the mind of these yogi means the three kinds of wisdom, especially the third one, wisdom gained through habituating in the meditation, habituating in the practice of anidruva, the wisdom. There should be, I think, two divisions. The wisdom, simulated wisdom, and the actual realization. Actual realization also comes as a category of the third wisdom, wisdom gained out of meditation. So that mustn't be included in that. That is the real yogi. That mustn't include in that. Because he says that minds can be established as, thus, if the minds of these yogis can be established as deceptive, we have to be very clear, very, very careful with that. It goes without saying that the same can be established about the minds of the common people. So in another word, common people's concept is totally sort of rooted in the ignorance. And the scholars or the wise people, their concept, many of their concept may be rooted in the wisdom. Wisdom knowing the relative reality, wisdom knowing the ultimate reality. So if the concept or the theories, if the concepts of the theories are rooted in the wisdom, the wisdom arisen from studying, wisdom arisen from the contemplation, wisdom arisen from meditating or habituating in the simulated understanding of the emptiness, if they can be established as deceptive, established as deluded, If these wisdom, three kinds of wisdom, can be established as a deluded mental state or deceptive mental state, it goes without saying that same can be established about the minds of common people. Well, now refuting objects concerning deceptive truth. So in this section, the ninth chapter, there is two lines depicting the true truths, the nature of the true truths. So that is important. Karamba says that the author did not present the characteristic of the true truth. Author just presented in the ninth chapter the basis of signifying the characteristic. Senshi. What is the English term for senshi? Basis of signification. Signifying the characteristic. Definition I'm not saying, because definition in English is just the meaning of the word, not the characteristic of anything. Like fire. We do not have the definition of fire in Tibetan. Me. We do not have that. Like path of accumulation, then we have the definition of that term. Chok lam. There's a meaning of chok and meaning of lam. So we have the definition of chok lam. And I think I would not use definition again now. It may bring confusion. It may lead you into a misunderstanding. So I would rather say characteristic. Characteristic. So these two lines, the ultimate truth is not object of mind, deluded mind, or mind with dualistic appearances. That is not a characteristic of the unique characteristic of the ultimate truth. Karamba says that is not. There are some Tibetan scholars who sort of regard it the characteristic of ultimate truth. And then the second line shows the nature, any relative truth or deceptive truth or any conventional truth, I don't know. So here the author presented the true truths from the subjective aspect, not from the objective aspect, from the subjective aspect. That is why these two lines shows the basis of the signification of characters, basis of signifying the characteristic of the true truths, not the actual characteristic. And in the true truths, the text called true truth, there is specific lines which shows again the nature of the true truth from the viewpoint of the objective aspect. Now the characteristic, actual characteristic, Karamba, he would say, depend on his sort of interpretation on the characteristic, he relies his interpretation of the actual characteristic of the two truths two lines given in the sixth chapter of Madhyamika Avatara. Thongwa Dzunpa Kasa Yangda Thongyu Khangyi Thingye Te Thongwa Dzunpa Kunzab Denparsung. There's two lines there. Yangda Thongyu Khangyi Thingye Te Thongwa Dzunpa Kunzab Denparsung. So he referred to that. It is quite complicated. This is a really complex presentation on the true truth, is really a complex or very complicated. It may take longer time, so I'll not mess up with many things now. Shouldn't bring up more and more sort of things here. So anyhow, here we need to think of the actual characteristic, basis of signifying the characteristic. We need to know difference between these two. The most important thing is to know the actual characteristic. So when you have the understanding of the actual characteristic, then you can define which kind of phenomena, which kind of mental state, which kind of arirarva, which kind of phenomena and it must be categorized as, must be posited as, must be regarded as the relative reality or relative truth, which can be regarded as the ultimate truth. We can do that, we can sort of differentiate or distinguish between the two sort of nature, relative nature and the ultimate nature, only out of the understanding of the actual characteristics. So knowing the actual characteristic, and in order to stabilize that understanding of the actual characteristic, you need to apply that towards the many bases of signification. Many bases of signification, like actual characteristic of the ultimate truth, the selflessness of person, selflessness of phenomena, selflessness of objective aspect, selflessness of subjective aspect, selflessness of any, like in the Madhyamika Avatara, in the Heart Sutra, no air, no eye, no eyes. You say, we morning, we all the time say, there's no eye, no eye, no ear, no. So there should be some kind of understanding of that true reality of the eye, true reality of the ear. Then out of that understanding, when we recite, then it becomes a very, really powerful recitation, in order to drive away the harms, invisible harms caused by the invisible spirits, what you call as a black magic or black energy. In Germany, some of the people call black energy, black magic or so on. So I've lived there. So from tomorrow I'll go more quicker. With this merit, may I attain omniscience and defeat the foes of mental affliction. May all sentient beings be liberated from the ocean of samsara, which is disturbed by the strong waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. Just as Manjukosha knows all, so as Samandra Bhadra does, may I follow all of them and dedicate all the merits. The place which become a supreme refuge, nourishing the northern area, filled with oceans of scholars and saints, may the Sakya teachings which illuminate the teachings of the Buddha in the land of snow prosper.